This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a tip of the cap to Cape Breton miners, those here and those who've passed, marking an important event later this month. Also, we'll hear from James Hibbert, former member of the U.S. competitive cycling team and recent author of The Art of Cycling, a book blending bicycle riding with his interest in Western philosophy and his views on modern life, especially in the Silicon Valley, California. That's up first with Paul McDougall on The Good Sentence.
So, James, I believe I may be your first Canadian interviewer about your book, The Art of Cycling. Is that right?
That is right, and I have a Canadian mother-in-law, so it's all the more personal. So I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you so much, Paul.
Oh, that's fantastic. Where's your mother-in-law from?
She's from just outside Manitoba.
Oh, excellent, right? Western Canada. So from Western Canada to Eastern Canada. So for our Coast listeners, we have James Hibbert here, and James is calling in from California. I'm just going to have James tell our listeners just a little bit about himself, and then we're going to start talking about his really interesting and quite a different and unique concept book.
So I was born in the early 80s in the Silicon Valley of California, and the sort of residue of the 1960s counterculture was still relatively strong. My father studied philosophy at the university level, both in Northern California and for a time in Germany in the 60s. And I grew up racing my bike, starting off at the local velodrome, sort of the way other American kids play Little League Baseball. The velodrome was very nearby, and from the time I was 12 or 13 years old, I was there and just really smitten by the sport. It was a sort of gladiatorial environment, racing under the lights, and it just struck me as incredibly interesting and this sort of contest of suffering. I was not like a lot of cyclists, endurance athletes. I was not much to speak of when it came to ball sports, but I understood sort of what running and cycling were and was just fascinated by the suffering aspect more than anything else. So growing up, there were still a lot of local cycling clubs, and these clubs were sort of populated by older riders who would mentor the younger riders who came in. The men and women involved tended to be sort of this counterculture ilk. This was the days prior to Lance Armstrong, so cycling was sort of more Europhilic. People who liked Bergman and Fellini movies tended to like bike racing and reading philosophy, so all of the sort of threads that are in the Art of Cycling certainly had a lot to do with my upbringing in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And so you spent 95 to 2005, 10 years as a very competitive cyclist, correct?
That's right. I started off and was the California junior state champion, and then onto the junior national team, the senior national team, and a professional team called Shackley, followed by a great Canadian Olympian as a teammate named Eric Wolberg, followed by racing for a team called HealthNet in my last year of racing in 2005, by which point I'll be candid with you and listeners, I was just exceptionally burned out. I think the sort of another thread that I definitely touch on in the book is this sort of cloistered U.S. Olympic Training Center type program where I remember just being flying out there and being out there for months on end and just being on the sort of ragged edge of what my body could tolerate. And by the time I was in my mid-20s, that last year, 2005, I was absolutely burned out and really wanting to pursue academic philosophy, which I'd always been interested in. I'd always had these sort of two lives in terms of wanting to be a competitive athlete very, very badly, but also sort of in some strange ways undermining that. I remember being at a national championship or a national cup type race and reading Saint-Exupéry the night before a Team Pursuit final. I don't know if any listeners are familiar, but he wrote a book called Wind, Sand, and Stars, a French aviator who's a very philosophical writer as well. And just being so exceptionally moved by that the night before, whereas everyone else had their legs up and was sort of behaving like a proper athlete, I was there reading and sort of dreaming of things literary and philosophical. So there were always these two, at times, competing threads going on in terms of my personality.
I should tell our readers the tagline for your book is The Art of Cycling, but it's philosophy, meaning, and a life on two wheels. And I think you've fairly well explained that now. You had said, you know, by 2005, you were coming to the end, you were burned out. You also say in the book, you talk about, you know, now the book is, you know, a number of years later when you've written it and reflected on it. But you say, looking back, you realize you were suffering some version of depression. But you said there's a great line in it in the book. You said, for years, cycling forbade me from becoming what I was, deeply sad. Do you want to elaborate just a little bit on that? Because it sounds like fairly profound and probably a thing that some people, you know, they suffer from. But everybody's always trying to say, well, why so sad? Don't be so sad, right?
Yeah, and I think that sort of in recent years, there's been more acceptance about both the mental health problems that sort of result from sports, but I think also that people who are innately struggling are also attracted to elite-level sports. I mean, what it provides is, even in very simple physiological terms, you're always exhausted, you're not going to be quite as depressed and anxious. You have this sort of exceptionally structured life that's very goal-oriented, on a just sort of day-by-day basis in terms of planning one's time. You know, you might only be physically on the bike for 4 or 6 hours, but essentially you start to block off your day with eating and traveling and washing a bike and nutrition and stretching, and pretty much every minute of your day is accounted for in a very rigorous way. And for me, the sort of ability to have all of that structure really did sort of stave off, but I think in some less than helpful ways, sort of kick the can of being depressed down the road. There's a funny sort of, and I mention this frequently in the book, but it's sort of like gambler's mentality to being a professional athlete. You sort of always have this distant carrot, and almost regardless of how successful you are or not, you sort of think, well, if I just do this different type of interval, or my handlebars are a little bit lower, this will change everything. And there's this sort of obsessive gambler's pursuit that I think also ties into some of the mental health issues. You're always sort of thinking that something is going to change and be better, and that with just a little bit more success, perhaps you, in fact, will feel different. One more win and everything will change. And I think that's what both makes sports attractive to people with mental health struggles, but also why so many in the wake of their career can tend to struggle. I mean, the one that really comes to mind, far more successful athlete than myself, Michael Phelps, who's been exceptionally candid. When you sort of get out of this ecosystem of structure and the instant feedback loop of success, of winning, and that sort of euphoric high, the rest of life after being an athlete can be rather tricky.
You have a fascinating line in the book. I'm kind of paraphrasing, but it says, cycling helps draw me out of my head. I'm no longer thinking, I merely am, which of course fits in with some of your notions on philosophy as well, correct? You want to elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I think that philosophy is a funny sub-discipline in this day and age, because it's sort of made fun of unemployed people with philosophy degrees working at McDonald's if they're lucky, and it's irrelevant, and it's sort of gone from a discipline that was for thousands of years highly respected, right? This idea of it being the sort of queen of the sciences and all knowledge, to now being this sort of in some ways, I would say, less respected than even an English degree, right? It's sort of slightly more esoteric. I sort of, throughout the book, make the argument both implicit and explicit that I think that, in fact, philosophy, in as much as you sort of go back to Plato, is very much in the business of abstraction, right? Of thinking more about how you move from the particular to the general. So as society has become far more virtual and detached, I'd argue that a lot of the sort of internet detachment and things we see now are, in fact, have their roots in philosophy, in Western philosophy, and specifically in Platonism. So I wanted to very much tap into that thread, tell the story of Western philosophy as one of devaluing the tangible and the bodily and the immediate world, and point out how prevalent that, in fact, is in the sort of modern day and age, and offer cycling as a counterpoint to that sort of abstraction and detachment. And it may as well have been woodworking or playing the violin or gardening. I think that just moving back to something that's tangible and embodied and particular, as opposed to something that is abstract or virtual or detached from the world, is fundamentally what I was most interested in exploring.
Well, I think as a reader, and I'll let our listeners know that the book is basically kind of set up in three parts that you weave one from the other to the other, and one is, you know, your beginning and how you became a competitive cycler. Then the other is the sections on Western philosophy, and which really you cover little bits of a lot of philosophers and in an easy understanding way with examples of what they were trying to tell. And then the third section is a number of years after you've given up cycling, you want to go on a ride of redemption or whatever, a long 3-day ride ending up in Big Sur, California with two of your old race mates. So it's these three things going on. And then, you know, a number of years later, your book is there. And it's all meshed together, which makes it's really fascinating, and it's a different way to look at it. And I think anybody could be interested in it, but I think people that do ride and do cycle, and I cycle a lot. I cycle all the time. I'm no racer or anything, but I love it. And I think the fact that the things that you mentioned, where it can get you out of your head, you can forget what you're doing, you're just trying to get to the end. I think for just a regular kind of cyclist like myself, those are good things. That's actually part of why I'm doing it, right? But you've got some good, really interesting insight into the bicycle. So you said in one point, as an object, the bicycle only makes any sense in relation to the peculiarities of the human body. Now, I get it from what you said after I read it, but tell our readers what you meant by that, because I think that's just fascinating.
Well, I mean, you can sort of imagine an alien dropping down and looking at a bicycle, having never seen a human being. And it's a very strange-looking thing. I mean, you can sort of walk around the rest of the world, and certainly there's things that would be, you know, ergonomic and designed to the human body in the most literal sense, but few things as ergonomic as the bicycle. So I think that you can almost even extrapolate, you know, how flexible someone is, where their handlebars positioned relative to the saddle, how tall they are. So it's a very interesting object that tells you not just about the person's size, like a suit, but even how their body functions and how flexible they are or not. How they sit on the bike is exceptionally telling to the trained eye. So I think that the bicycle, as it relates to a human being, is a particularly unique tool, even amongst other things that I mentioned, right? A skilled musician certainly knows their instrument, but that instrument doesn't reflect their level of fitness or their particular morphology the same way a bicycle of a racing cyclist does.
Yeah, it's that was all. That's quite interesting. You make another neat point where you say, you know, there's only really three points of contact, you know, the saddle, you know, where you're gripping at the handlebars, and of course the pedals. But then you say then when you think about it, the contact of the bike to the road is really, at any given time, only 2 square centimeters. So I had read that, and I was out biking myself yesterday, and then that thought came into my head. And I thought,
as you're descending.
Yes, exactly. I thought, what? So tell us just a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that everything you're sort of learning. So we're going back on this issue, sort of circling around this issue of conscious thought when you're riding a bike. And I think what's very interesting is you're certainly thinking and you're reacting to a whole heap of information coming through the handlebars, coming through the saddle. Are your tires slipping as you're going around a corner? Do you need to be on the brakes more? Is your wheel about to lock up? There's all these sort of pre-conscious, certainly not executive functioning, rational things like you think with philosophy. It's the exact opposite when you're on a bike. So I think that taking in all that manifold of information from the bike is really what separates a skilled cyclist from a neophyte, but also is what sort of forces your executive functioning to calm down. This sort of game of planning and strategy and what should one do to get a promotion and all of the sort of other garbage that people often makes them sad and depressed and anxious because they feel as if their mind is not their own, but rather sort of going through all this contortionism. All of that gets turned off as soon as you have this sort of immediacy of being on the bike and all of these sensations that you're interpreting and acting upon, just as when you're going down a hill or something like that. You know, when you're hitting the brakes, when you're shifting, your mind and body are in fact doing a great deal, but the better you are, the less that is brought to any sort of conscious level of attention.
Yes, and exactly, and as someone, like I've ridden for a long time, many, many years, and
right.
When after reading the book, I'm thinking of some of the things that you say, and I think, yeah, that's right. I know what I'm doing, but then, you know, when you run into someone who doesn't really ride much, or the first thing they ask you, like, and all I really do is road bicycling. I just love it.
Right.
And the first thing they said, do you worry about the traffic? Well, cripes, I've been at it 40 years. If I was worrying about the traffic, I wouldn't be on the bike.
Right.
You know, I'd be doing something else, right? Because I feel like this is one thing I myself have sort of somewhat know what I'm doing. I've not mastered anything, but I feel comfortable and I know what I'm doing. You had another wonderful line. The bicycle can dislodge us from the endless stream of technical distraction that categorizes modern life. And you were sort of hinting at it there today with what modern life really is about. You want to just tell us a bit more about how you what you think of things in 2023 and how you can maybe make your own life better?
Yeah, I think that certainly, I mean, I don't want to sort of be geographically overdeterministic, but I think certainly my sitting in the Silicon Valley has made me think about these matters a great deal. And I think that it's very interesting how jobs and sort of ideas that are novel and abstract, namely writing code or coming up with some novel way to dispatch a taxi cab or whatever else, those are the things that tend to be rewarded rather than things that involve a great deal of care and skill and attention to a tangible task. And I think that overall that's not just for mental health, but just for sort of general happiness is not necessarily the best way to live, this sort of divorced from the world type situation. And following the philosophical thread of the book, there's certainly some thinkers that anticipated this state of affairs. Certainly thinkers like Nietzsche, a little bit later, like Martin Heidegger, thinkers that are very concerned about this philosophical drive to the abstract and want to call our attention back to the immediacy of lived life and the poignancy of experience. And I think that cycling certainly is capable of doing that.
Yes, I after reading your book, so much of it makes sense. And let's go to modern life then, and your recent cycling trip, and you're riding with your friends, and because you have nice descriptions of, you know, trying to keep up, there were two of them and yourself, trying to keep up, or you get behind, and then you're thinking back to when you used to race and all this. And then, of course, there's wonderful descriptions of the scenery and everything, and going down hills and then climbing up them and being cold and warm, all that. I loved all that. But you have this fantastic line where you say, gas stations remain the great equalizers in America. So let's just talk about that. Whoop. Oh no. Shoot. Oh, shoot.
I'm super happy that you actually picked that line out, Paul, and picked up on that. This is actually a thread that I haven't spoken to a whole lot of people about, but I think for me is actually a sort of outsized part of the book. I think that it's very easy when you're a professional athlete to sort of think that things revolve around you. And in fact, it's really the people that are running the sport who I think are the ones who are very much in control of it. And I think that's informed my politics to a great extent that I sort of allude to with that line. I don't know what the Canadian sort of view of the United States is on this front, but I think the sort of polarized winner-take-all American capitalist structure, certainly I saw in professional sports and saw how the sport changed with not just doping, but with Armstrong and the U.S. Postal Service team in the late 90s and early 2000s. And I think that there's a clear political message that falls out of that. I think there's a number of professional athletes that either become strangely conservative, believing that they've pulled themselves up by their proverbial bootstraps, as the American saying goes. And I actually took a sort of opposite lesson, that it's a lot of luck and structural factors and cheating and doing whatever is necessary for people to succeed. And that probably has oriented my politics to a larger degree than I would even like to admit as an adult. Sort of going into an ecosystem of professional sports, thinking that it was chariots of fire, meritocratic, and realizing what the real game rules were. So I think that line at the gas station, sort of being very class conscious when you've got in the United States, but everyone from gardeners and pickup trucks to in Carmel, where I made that reference to that gas station, to, you know, it's the second, Clint Eastwood was the mayor, and these are the second homes of the Silicon Valley elite. So really bringing all of that to the forefront was something that I was also interested in exploring in the ride thread of the book.
Yeah, I think it was just so really neat. And as soon as I read it too, I had this like a kind of like a Stephen King moment, because you know, I don't know if you read Stephen King, but a lot of his books they're so set in America, and you know, just the milieu of all the different people, the mixes of the people, and you never know who you're going to run, you know, of course, is the horror stories and all this stuff, but you never know when you're going to pass someone, right, or meet someone, you know, a dark, malevolent figure, and does something bad happen to you, or do you get escape and not even know the risk. And I just thought, my, you know, that's that whole thing about the gas station and where everybody meets. You're either driving like a 20-year-old beater of a car, or someone pulls up with $200,000 Hummer or whatever, but it is, you know, it's the great equalizer. I think your second book, you should name it that. It's just so, it's...
Well, what's funny too is I think that especially in coastal enclaves in the United States at the moment, everything is being increasingly set up such that different strata of society have no need to interact with one another. Gated communities where people live, and the affluent shop at different grocery stores, and everything is just increasingly sort of stratified. So I do think that the gas station is an increasingly interesting cultural place, and sort of throughout a sort of road trip genre that I certainly am indebted to, books like Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Jack Kerouac's On the Road, the American gas station has this sort of outsized cultural significance to it that I always have found very interesting and certainly wanted to at least pay heed to in the book.
Yeah, so true. You mentioned Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, the Persig book from many years ago, and in your book you talk a little bit about Zen, and then you there's a real proverb that you tell there, and it's the Zen master sees five kids show up on bicycles, and he asked them all why they're riding their bicycle. Well, one it's just to carry home something in the basket, and another one is to get here and there or whatever, and then the fifth kid says that line, I ride my bicycle because I ride my bicycle. And the Zen master says, right. I'm now your teacher. It's just so, it's a fantastic line. But that's the way I feel when I ride my bicycle. When someone says, why do you do that? Because I do it. That's why I do it.
Well, and I think that there's something to that Zen proverb that really transcends just cycling. I think that so much of what we're taught is necessary for success is this sort of instrumental thinking. Like, if I do X, then good, fortuitous Y result will take place. And that result tends to be economically pragmatic, vocationally pragmatic, whatever the case might be. So I think that doing something merely for the sake of doing it is a sort of novel proposition at this point, and feels to a great number of people like a luxury. So even when something like yoga or relaxation or meditation are sort of undertaken, at least here in the Silicon Valley, the idea is often these are undertaken in order to become more productive. I can write more code if I have just done yoga, or the quality of my work will be better. So I think that even things that are sort of regenerative practices, like yoga, like perhaps riding a bike, can often be sort of turned into instruments to be more productive, or I'm going to be healthier in order to get more work done, or lower my cholesterol. So I think that getting out of that line of positive instrumental thinking is very, very necessary to sort of redeem our life and existence in a very fundamental way.
It's all really interesting, James. I just the whole concept, the book. It's about 300 pages, and you would have had a UK publisher first, and now it's just last month American publisher has picked it up. So and it's it's pretty well available for our listeners. Amazon.ca is the easiest way to get something like this, but it's a fantastic book, and I'm seeing it everywhere, Cycle World publications, stuff like that. They're picking up on it, as well as philosophers and people that write on philosophy books. I mean, you've cornered something there. You've got a unique argument, if that's the term, but it says a lot, and it's really interesting. And I think for philosophy students, like let's say you were in say second year philosophy class and you were struggling with some of who some of these people are and what they mean and that.
Right.
It's like a nice, the philosophy segments are a nice little history of Western philosophy. You start from the beginning, you go right up to the modern philosophers, and there's enough there that you learn something, and if you know nothing about philosophy, you will. And I find you don't get bogged down. So I hope some of our listeners...
That was an aim. Thank you, Paul. That means a lot, because not getting bogged down in philosophy is a difficult, tedious task. I'm sure that you or some listeners have read, like, Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy or Frederick Copleston. It's I think, very difficult to tell the story of philosophy without putting the thinkers into conversation with one another, and then it can quickly become very bogged down and onerous. So, thank you, Paul.
No problem. And that's not what it is. It's really neat. It's an interesting book. I hope some of our listeners will just seek this out. You got a favorite philosopher, basically, in a nutshell? I mean, I've read it. I've got some ideas.
It without a doubt, is Friedrich Nietzsche.
Yeah.
I think is by far the most interesting thinker of certainly the last 500 years. I think that what he was accomplished in the late 19th century really prefigures so much of where we're at now that it's just simply incredible to go back and read Nietzsche. Sort of as his mental health declined, he described himself as dynamite, and the sort of ripples of his thought would continue through the centuries, and I think that prophecy on his part is really held true.
Well, that's really neat, and it's interesting too in the book, because you know you go back to talk about your father and his interest in philosophy, and some of it started there. So you know, just once again, it's really interesting. The book is called The Art of Cycling: Philosophy, Meaning, and a Life on Two Wheels by James Hibbard. You plug in Art of Cycling, listeners, and this is going to pop up, and you may see two versions of it. One brand new just came out. So we're going to thanks, James, for this. It's been great talking to you way out on the West Coast, California, from the pretty well furthest east other than Newfoundland on the East Coast. So you got a couple of good sentences you want to leave us with from the book?
I do. The couple of good sentences begin, "The idea of meaning, of the demand for all of one's efforts to be compelled by some justifiable outcome, is in many ways a modern malady. And I've come to think of cycling not simply as a sport, but as a practice more akin to art than anything else. A means to, in Nietzsche's words, quote, give style to oneself. And like great art, cycling derives its beauty precisely from the fact that it has no, quote, in order to, end quote, no purpose or ulterior motive. Endowed with just as much significance as you bring to it, like the notes of Beethoven, the words of Plath, or the brushstrokes of Van Gogh, cycling is at once what it is superficially, while always being something far more."
We get up in the mic,
down the cold town road,
and we hike along the track,
where the cold trains flow.
And we make the ponies pull till they nearly break their backs, and we'll never see again.
Down the cold town road,
we hear the whistle call.
On June 11, 1925, Bill Davis was shot and killed by company police after coal miners and their families were protesting the company's decision to shut off power and water to try to force the miners back to work. Since then, Cape Bretoners and those offshore of the island have marked Davis Day. Bill Bradley will tell you in a few minutes about events coming up in Sydney Mines. First, we'll hear from Jim McClellan of the Men of the Deeps telling the story of William Davis.
The miners are making $3.65 a day, and they're only working 1 or 2 days a week. So times were tough. You know, there was no way they were getting a raise. And the president, I think his name was Slavin, he gave them you either take a 10% raise or there's no contract. Now, the union executive would have none of that, you know. So then they said, walked out and operated on the old contract for 2 months. And as would happen, the company were ruthless. They cut off the food at the grocery stores, they cut off the water, they cut off the electricity. And, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 people were starting to starve. It was just, it was unbelievable that it could happen. When you read about it, and the stories you read by independent writers, you know, they all jive. It happened. It's hard to believe that it happened. But, you know, the company decided to really put the guns to our people, and they hired, about 100 and 150 men on horseback with rifles. They were called soldiers, but they weren't. They were thugs in the Halifax area, or somewhere up that way, you know where it was. But they ruled the roost. You know, they drove up and down, it was all in the Waterford, I should have said. And they drove up and down Plummer Avenue, and they were charging at people and scaring the devil out of them and threatening them and doing all kinds of things. It was just intimidation from the early morning to the late evenings, you know. They even drove through schoolyards threatening kids and scaring the devil out of them with rifles and so on, you know. So the miners, you know, they got together around, I guess it was around maybe near the middle of June or near the middle of May. And they decided they would pull the maintenance people out of the power station. And then they put up a picket line. But then those fellows came riding in with their horses and their guns and everything, and they overrode the picket line and chased them off. So then, on June 11th, 1925, the miners all gathered on the streets in the Waterford. There was about maybe 350, 400 people. And they were joined by miners from New Waterford, and outlying districts like Reserve, Dominion, Glace Bay, and Sydney Mines. And soon they had about 3,000. And they marched on the water plant and the power station, you know. When they got there, it was a big fence with barbed wire across the top, and the horses and men were lined up behind, ready to charge. So it was quiet for a minute, and before the union executive could make their demands, they opened the gates and the horses charged through among everyone, the guys shooting and hollering and screaming and hitting them with rifles, and it was a total mess. But the miners stood still. They stood fast. There was no way. They overcame the horses. They pulled the guys out the horses and gave them a good crack in the ear. But in all that, there were some shots fired. One guy was shot in the arm. One guy was shot in the leg. Another fellow had a broken back. Another fellow had a broken neck. And there was all kinds of injuries, even with kids and even with women. And there was one shot that went through a fellow's heart, and that was Bill Davis. And that sort of calmed everything down. The guy was shot, a fellow miner. Everyone was heartbroken. And the miners vowed at that time they weren't going back in honor of Bill Davis, and they held fast. And finally, the federal and provincial governments did what they should have done 2 or 3 years ago. They came in and settled the whole thing, get the miners, not a decent wage, but a better wage. You know, and everybody was happy. And the miners vowed at that time that they'd never work on Davis Day. And they never did.
In 1720 they sailed to CB in search for coal that outcropped by the sea. They settled the land round Morion Bay. 'Twas here coal mining started, they say.
Musha do do we ya, sing it fall do we addy. Musha do do we ya, sing it fall do we yay.
The immigrants came from far and wide to work in the coal mine side by side. Mates became buddies and brothers to be down in the deeps of old CB.
Musha do do we ya, sing it fall do we addy. Musha do do we ya, sing it fall do we addy. Musha do do we ya, sing it fall do we addy. Musha do do we ya.
When the mine shut down at Morion Bay, they packed up and left to work in Glace Bay. Many mines did they open in this big town. Only number 26 is still to be found.
Coal mining spread to many a town. As far as we know, it will always be your
around. Hey, Breton is rich in coal, you see. It all began with that coal by the sea. Much ado, do we are singing Paul, do we Addy. Much ado, do we are singing Paul, do we Addy. Much ado, do we are singing Paul, do we Addy. Much ado, do we are singing Paul.
Coming up on Sunday, June 11th, it is Miners Memorial Day, Davis Day, as we know it here on Cape Breton Island. And back on June 11th, 1925, when William Davis was shot dead in protest against what was going on back then. And with us, representing the United Mine Workers of America, Bobby Birchall, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Since 1925, you think that the crowds would actually go down going to Miners Memorial Day, but we noticed kind of an influx before COVID, people actually coming out and supporting miners and remember miners that passed on, not just here in Cape Breton, but all over Canada now.
Well, the first Miners Day celebration was in 1926, and there was over 400 attended that one at the time. And since then, it was pretty steady. But then for a few years, it kind of dwindled down, because back in the earlier days, when I first started in the mines, basically the banks, the schools, the stores, everybody closed down for the day in remembrance of Bill Davis, and a lot of people attended the services, and eventually that kind of eased off. Some banks close now for half a day. Most of the stores stay open. A lot of them, I guess, have forgot what our history is all about. Unfortunately, during COVID, we had to cancel Davis Day for two years, and that was the first time that it was ever canceled. Last year, we started Davis Day back up again, and we held it at the Miners Museum. There was a wonderful crowd there, and as you said, prior to COVID, the crowds start picking up again, and I think people are starting to realize the importance of Davis Day a lot more as they get older, and a lot of them are telling their children about the history, and the children are showing a lot more interest in it. So hopefully it'll continue to be a day of remembrance, and people will take the time to show up and remember Bill Davis and all the other miners who were sacrificed so that we could have what we have today.
Now, you've been a representative for the United Mine Workers for a very long time now. I hate to put a number on it, but how long have you been doing this?
Well, I retired in 2017 after 34 years with the mine working for the union, and I've basically been doing Davis Day services myself since 2020, and before that, the district looked after it, and since 2020, I've basically been organizing it and doing it with a lot of help from the local unions here and our retirees and Men of the Deeps, of course. Without them, Davis Day, they certainly make it a day.
This year, it's going to be held in Sydney Mines, also a mining town.
We've always held it. We rotate it every year.
Hold
it in New Waterford 1 year, Glace Bay the next, and Sydney Mines the next. Of course, during COVID, there was 2 years we didn't do it. Last year, it was supposed to be held at Sydney Mines, but because of the unveiling of the new monuments for the miners that lost their lives in 26 Calgary, we wanted to have it there for the unveiling of those monuments. And Sydney Mines agreed to trade turns. So this year, it'll be in Sydney Mines. Next year, it'll be in Glace Bay. It'll be their regular turn. The 100th anniversary is in 2025. And it'll be held where it all started in New Waterford.
In Sydney Mines, of course, there was Prince's Colliery and then, of course, Prince Colliery. And as far as I know, there was only two in Sydney Mines. Is that correct?
Well, there was Prince Colliery and Sydney Mines. There was the new mine that opened out in Alder Point was Prince's.
Okay.
And back in the day, there was several other smaller mines running. There's the Five Star. Ironically, the Birchall family in Sydney Mines owned a couple of mines over there. No relation. At one time, I know when I started in the mines myself in 1976, between New Brunswick and Pictou and Cape Breton and Inverness, and like up in Inverness, Cape Breton, we had close to 10,000 miners with
them. And my dad was a miner. A couple of uncles were miners as well, and you probably know them. A couple of Capsticks, John Capstick, Joey Capstick, and probably were with them over the years. And, of course, rich in history in coal mining here in Cape Breton, Sydney Mines, De Waterford, Lingan, and Glace Bay, and, of course, also Westray. Everybody remembers what happened in Westray. That was such a huge tragedy.
It was, and we still remember them every year. Mining, it runs deep in the blood in Nova Scotia. A lot of people remember and continue to remember, and I just hope that tradition continues. As long as I'm able to do it, we'll be celebrating David's Day. And I hope when I'm no longer able, someone will pick up the torch and carry it on.
So for folks that have never been to a David's Day, June the 11th, what can you expect when you go to the Cenotaph and City Mines?
Well, we start off, it'll be starting off at 10 a.m. at the Anglican Church on 15 Queen Street in Sydney Mines. We'll hold a service there. And then after the service, we go down to the Miners Park, and across from the old Prince Mine, by the way, on Pitt Street. And there people lay wreaths. We have guest speakers, and people talk about Davis Day, and the Davis family usually have they've continuously had a large turnout of Bill Davis's descendants show up at Davis Day. They never miss it. They're always well represented. And then after that, we normally, at this time in Sydney Mines, we'll, after the service is over, we invite everybody up to the Legion on Main Street for some tea, coffee, and sandwiches and sweets, and a chance for the miners to get together and reminisce and talk about the good old days.
Well, listen, I really appreciate your comments here today, and want to say thank you on behalf of all of the miners and the miners' families for keeping this going.
Well, I appreciate it, and it's a lot of help. We get a lot of help. The Miners Museum, they're front and center each year when we have it, and the local communities are very supportive. They're still very supportive. I just wish we could go back to the days when they would show true honor and shut down all the stores and the banks and allow people to come out in more numbers to remember our history and our heritage. I'll tell you, I have a daughter that lives in Calgary who has two children, and we have a daughter that lives in Halifax that has three children, and June the 11th, they don't allow their kids to go to school.
That's absolutely incredible. And again, thank you from all of the mining community. Continued success with having Davis Day.
I appreciate that, and thank you, Bill, and hope to see everybody there on June the 11th at Sydney Mines.
Closing out the show this week with a segment from the National Film Board of Canada called Men of the Deeps, a moving portrait of a group of former Cape Breton miners gathered together in the early 2000s. Many of the men started working in the mines as teenagers, coal dust filling the grooves on their face, working side by side in a black pit where death could come at any time. Those days are gone now. Many of them had to find new work, some trading the pick and shovel for a mouse in one hand and an old-fashioned landline telephone in the other. However, a lot of them would return to the bowels of the earth to chip away, to make a living providing for their families.
I went through a period where it was pretty rough. I didn't know if I was going to make it. I wasn't sure if I wanted to make it. Some people try to talk to you as if they're smarter than you. And I really get the judge of them people. I'm a 42-year-old miner. And they're going around with computer lingo. But I won't carry a chip on my shoulder over that either because, God knows, someday I might be one of them.
Never know.
I doubt it too, but you know.
How's your weather in Pennsylvania today?
People call here from the United States of America. When you say hello on the other end, you don't know who you're going to get. And when you ask them what their problem is, you don't know what you're going to hear.
We're located in eastern Canada. A long way from you. I get a charge. People call. They want to speak to Bill Gates now. I said, "Oh, Bill's gone for the coffees, boy. You can't get him now." The pay is not what I'm used to, but I'm living. I'm still in Cape Breton. Bottom line, still in Cape Breton. Another satisfied customer. And people still ask the question, "Well, what happens if the mine's open tomorrow, Michael?
Would you go back?
Would you go back?" I wouldn't even empty my desk out. I'd just leave everything here.
You go?
I would.
I think I would, too.
Yeah.
You go?
I don't know.
You wouldn't let Michael and I get ahead of you, would you?
Yeah, maybe just this once.
When the light glows dark with the forces of creation across stormy skies, we look to reincarnation.
Times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.